Indeed it is, with Sidney Rossinger, our special guest. You just get up to his websites and you'll see some of the incredible work he has done. He's a medical anthropologist, and we'll be back with more, much more to talk with him about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Sidney Rossinger. Sidney, let's get into this. This is an incredible story. So skin cancer on the bottom of the foot because of shoes.
Yes. Well, your feet are soaking in the marinating in the toxins that are inside shoes. Even if you're wearing socks, you know, your feet sweat, and then the shoe, it mixes with all those chemicals. So, you know, and I feel it on myself. If I wear certain types of plastic shoes, you know, like those Crocs or whatever, my feet can start breaking out. Like, I'm very sensitive to the plastic, even flip-flops. You know, those, when you sweat, your sweat's mixing with these things. What you need to do is smell these things. Take a new shoe and smell it and ask yourself if you want to consume that, because when it's on your skin, you're going to soak it right up. Your skin absorbs stuff. And, you know, it's just like you might as well be eating it. So, yeah, these are other hidden toxins in our lives.
Well, so what do you recommend? We walk around barefoot?
Well, in Hawaii, yeah. but
yeah, do you folks even wear clothes there?
As little as we can get away with, actually. No, it's a beautiful environment. I mean, man is meant to be free and natural, and I think our culture just really distorts and perverts it all. So in Hawaii, if it's, you know, you just wear, well, I don't want everybody to feel bad. So I won't go on about how great it is here, but we give people a chance to experience what it's like living naturally. You know, instead of, there are things that we do as animals that are, like, for example, foraging. On our place, we have all these wild fruits. You know, there's wild strawberry guava and thimbleberries and avocados, and they grow wild. So it's so much fun just walking through and looking for food and picking it. And you start to realize that's sort of like shopping behavior. People that live in urban, I'm from New York City. Okay, I was raised in New York.
All right.
And so I've gone from one extreme to the other.
Yes.
And I know what difference it really makes in your life. It's just, you have to try it and experience it to be free. And then when you are, you sometimes just don't want to go back. And that's why we live here. It's inconvenient for doing a lot of things. And there are frogs in the background when you're on the radio. And
I hear
like
those cokie frogs. That's
cokie
right.
Cokie frogs. But, and it just rains, so they're very happy. But, you know, that's the price you pay for living in paradise. But the advantage is you don't have the all the pollution, the cultural pollution. So it's not worth it.
Not at all. Well, let's get back to the shoes for just a moment. What do you recommend people do, honestly?
Well, I think you need to never wear shoes without socks, and make sure you change your socks so they don't get sweat mixing in with the shoes, and don't wear the shoes tight, because tight is bad. I don't care what you're wearing. Tight is bad. Elastic is bad. You know, elastic holds on by constriction. ACE bandages are bad. They all cut off circulation. I've talked to people about tight things in every area of their lives. You got to get rid of the tight stuff. We have a very tight culture. We like tight, you know, but it's not good. And you don't want to have tight shoes. I mean, look what tight shoes do to women with bunions and with hammer toes and on it elevates their with the heels, throws off their spine. It's just incredible what we do with constriction, deforming our bodies. But, you know, the Chinese bound feet for hundreds of years, deforming their women's feet and making them necrotic. The toes actually would rot away, and the men would change their wives' wrappings on their feet. It was erotic, and that was
what?
It was erotic. Oh yeah, foot binding in China was the thing to do, and it was a way of keeping women at home, making sure you knew where they were because they were hobbled. You know, they couldn't get around.
They couldn't move.
Right, and the man would come home and he would play with their feet and unwrap them. And it sounds disgusting and weird to us, but a tight bra, which constricting, you know, constriction to the point of push-up bras, where you know it's there's no such thing as a well-fitted push-up bra. It's designed to just squeeze the heck out of your breast. And of course it's going to create all sorts of disease. It's obvious if you could step out of your culture for a minute and look at it and be objective.
Can you put pads in the shoe?
To do what?
To block the chemicals from coming up?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we should have shoe condoms. You know, we can have wear something to protect us from contact with shoes. But they will make your feet kind of hot. Shoes are an invention. All of these are inventions. These are things that people came up with to try to deal with the elements and make life maybe a little easier in some cases. But, you know, I'll tell you, I raised my son here in Hawaii, and he walks barefoot everywhere. He trains horses barefoot. He walks on lava, not hot lava, but
right.
Lava barefoot.
Well, the entire island is part of that, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, but he's like barefoot, and he has very healthy, very strong feet. And I've discovered, in fact, through him, that because he was a deliberate experiment, we had him go barefoot. We wanted to see what effect, because my feet are typical. I mean, I wore shoes like everybody else, and my feet are extremely narrow. I have, toenail issues, and you get foot fungus issues, and it's basically from just constriction of my feet for years and years and years. And I'm a victim of foot binding. And my son has, you look at his feet, the toes are widespread. I mean, anybody who grew up on a farm understands what I'm talking about. Your toes are widespread. His muscles in his feet are very well developed. And he uses his feet to grip things, like when he's on a horse and riding it bareback and barefoot. He'll grip the horse around the shoulders with his feet. He uses them. They're actually usable.
But they're like hands, aren't they?
Like a hand. They're very prehensile. But we grow up in a culture where the feet are kept. Imagine if your hands were treated the way we treat our feet. Not just a glove, but a stiff outer shell. Your hand muscles would not develop properly. They'd atrophy. You wouldn't have anything proper like you do now if you use your hands. It's the same thing with the feet. But look how we take it so for granted. You got to wear shoes. We see little babies. They give them little shoes.
Yeah, that's true.
And then they won't develop the neurological connections with their feet that they need to develop. You should be tickling their feet, letting them walk around and getting sensitive and having their whole bodies being stimulated. You don't want to stick them in a shell and stick them in a diaper and stick them in shoes and stick them in a crib and stick them in the car seat and tie them down. And what are we creating? What are we creating by doing this control on ourselves?
Interesting. Interesting perspective on all that.
So. Yeah, I practice what I preach, George. I dropped out of the culture. I live in Hawaii because I did not want to be part of this crazy culture.
Now, remember, though, not everybody can drop out like you did.
Well, you're right. However, they can drop out a lot more than they do, and they could mitigate a lot of the problems, like by doing simple lifestyle changes. For example, changing the way you sleep, change the way you dress. If a woman can't go to work without a bra, because, and this is a fact, I mean, a lot of women are told, you know, they say, I'd love to be without a bra, but I can't go to work without a bra because it's just not professional or it's not whatever. That's called sexual harassment, okay? No man is forced to wear a jock strap at work unless it's appropriate for the job.
Where was it? There was a bank that let a teller go because they thought she was too provocative?
Well, yeah, I've heard stories like that. But, you know, I mean, the bra actually is the provocative garment. I mean, it's designed to change the shape. It pushes it up into your face. And I know some women think that they're doing it for modesty, but, you know, and I appreciate that. And large-breasted women think, oh, I need a bra. Well, you know, when I was in Fiji doing a follow-up to our U.S. study, our bra and breast cancer study we did in the early 90s, that's in Dress to Kill, we then did a follow-up study in Fiji. And we found, because here is like half the culture is bra-free and half wear bras, and we figured, okay, if we went village to village getting case histories of, and this is women with this, in a village, you have the same, they're all related, they're eating the same stuff, it's the same environment, it's like a controlled setting. But the ones who were working at the resort right next to the village had to wear a bra because it was, you know, usually owned by an Australian or a New Zealander in Fiji, and they wanted Western style. So these women, these Fijian women would strap on a bra. And they were the ones getting disease. I went to their health ministry with our information, and they said, well, this explains why we're getting breast cancer all of a sudden, and it's in our working women. They're the ones wearing the bras. They're teachers. They're nurses. To look professional, they have to look Western. That means bra. And that means breast disease. And their breast cancer rates are shooting up. I mentioned before how in Korea and Southeast Asia, you know, Eastern medicine understands the bra issue and constriction and lymphatics and all that. They understand flow of energy and you don't want to block it and all of that. They even consider the issue of the underwire, whether it's metal and what that might affect with energies. And they understand constriction and how important it is not to be constricted. But their women have been brainwashed now into compliance with bra wearing to where 100% are wearing bras and over 80% are sleeping in them 24/7. They never remove the bra. Now, when we came up with our research, George, in like 1995, when we were announcing all of this, people were saying, who would sleep in their bra? Because we found that group had like 3 out of 4 of the women doing that kind of behavior were getting major breast disease and cancer. It increased your risk from bra free. A bra free woman has about the same incidence of breast cancer as a man, which makes sense. We both have breasts. You know, but bra-free is about the same as a man. And you go throughout the world, if there are cultures that still don't wear bras, they have virtually no breast cancer. It's not a problem. It's background. But when you deal with, as soon as you start wearing the bras, their breast cancer rates skyrocket. But 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it was rare to sleep in a bra. But since our book came out, the bra industry has been pumping their propaganda. They've been trying to suppress us. They've been doing also. I have very long stories about all of this, which I'll save you for tonight. But I'll tell you, it's been incredible, the resistance. And
You've done some work in the arena of animals too. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm saying this as a guy who was raised in the city. Okay. I always loved animals, and I appreciate now that I live with them. I mean, we have, besides my 5 dogs and like 7 or 8 cats and the goats and sheep and horses and, you know, ducks and chickens, you know, we live in an interspecies community. All these animals are free. None of them are like collared or caged, and they roam and they do their thing, and we live with them. We feed them. They're friendly, and we get to observe their behavior and their language, and we can connect with them with their language. We understand them. They're much more intelligent than anybody ever gives them credit for. And I think what's missing right now a lot in our society is we don't have very good human-animal relationships. Even people who have a dog or a cat are usually living in a very artificial world, like in a house for the animals, that they're stuck indoors or they're tied up or whatever. You know, if they ever get their exercise after being in the house all day, you take them for a walk on a leash around the block real quick because you want to get home and you know, go on Facebook or something, and your dog doesn't get what he needs, and they have a lot of needs that aren't being met because of our culture. For example, like not going out when they need to go to the bathroom. They have to hold it in when they need to, you know, so they have to wait too, because we believe, we have to wait, the animal has to wait. Well, when they hold it in, it causes the same problems as when we hold it in. I wrote a book about that called Get It Out, which is about a lot of things, but it includes the problem that we have in our culture of being able to go to the bathroom when you need to. And that causes, you know, prostate enlargement. As your bladder swells and presses on your prostate, you can get kidney stones. You can get diverticulitis by holding in when you need to go to the bathroom, or even holding in when you need to let some pass wind. We can't do any of those things in our culture. And as a result, we build up all these toxins and all this waste. And, you know, that if you live in a farm, you don't have to hold it in. It's, you know, people in rural areas have much lower rates of prostate cancer, bladder problems, and all these, you know, problems associated with holding it in, which is an urban problem. They've actually identified these as, higher economic status people have different health problems than rural, low economic status people who can just be more natural.
What does modern medicine folks say about what you do?
Well, I think the first thing they do is gulp, because it makes so much sense. If they're open-minded, they completely agree with me that it makes sense. I encourage further research, and all of these ideas. But typically, I think medicine is kind of defensive. They're supposed to be the experts. I'm this guy that got... See, I was in 3 PhD programs and in medical school, and I was on a full scholarship, and, you know, I could have been like the guy running these institutions.
Sure.
But I'm not that kind of a person. I never wanted to be pigeonholed, cubbyholed, that this is how you have to practice. Because after you go on a PhD program, let's say, you know, for the first 2 years, you're getting your education, your reading, and getting all that. The last 2 years, you have to do your dissertation, and that's like becoming one of them. And it's a real absorption into their institution, the way they do things, their paradigm, and this is what you are.
Well, then they've got to like this dissertation. They've got to accept it, right?
Yeah, you have to show you're one of them. You have to be one of them. And I always felt that I just think outside the box. I didn't want to get into any box. And I've always felt that I know that if I would have had all the credentials that I could have had, I might have people listening to me more because they think I must be the expert because you have the credentials. But my whole approach is to say, I don't want people to listen to me because I have credentials. You should listen if it makes sense to you, and then try it on yourself. Everything I say, you got to try on yourself to see if it makes sense to you. And the good thing is, you don't have to buy anything. I mean, this is not like a sales pitch. You know, it's simple. Do it for yourself and see if you feel better. I was shocked when I went to medicine to see how they didn't really care about people. They don't pick doctors on their humanitarianism. They pick them on their test scores and their ability to comply. And when I was a real thorn in their side in medical school because I started getting back to the animal question. You know, I actually was repulsed by the animal research aspect of medicine, the vivisection, the torture of that goes on. Animals. Hundreds of millions of animals get tortured. I was not going to deal with that. When I was in biochemistry at Duke University, I was a graduate student in biochemistry. There was enough animal stuff I saw. And I also worked at NIH for a while. And, I mean, I got exposed to animal research to where it disgusted me. Smart.
What do they use the most, rabbits and rats or what?
It depends on what you're doing. I mean, at UTMB in Galveston, where I went to medical school, they were doing burn research on dogs, you know. And I don't even want to get into it because there's probably some listeners who are going to be very upset. It upset me so much, George, that I refused to participate in the dog lab that they have as a demonstration for medical students where they kill a dog through this process.
Good for you.
And I refused, and it took a lot. I had to threaten a lawsuit, and I became a pariah. I mean, everybody was, if you don't conform, you really scare them in medicine.
Well, you were the rabble-rouser, right?
Well, they thought so.
They thought so.
And I was trying to simply, I was asking tough questions. I was saying things like, well, wait a minute, if poverty is known to be associated with disease, then why aren't we dealing with poverty instead of just treating the disease? You know, let's address the cause. Well, you say that and your peers look at you dumbfounded. They can't argue with you, but the problem is they're being trained to think medicine. That means, you know, first day of medical school, you get books and gifts from the drug companies. They're the ones who teach you, and that's what it's all about. It's like, what drug do you give? And anyway, I was so desensitized. I got so disgusted with medicine, realizing that it was all about drugs, all about animal research, because every drug is tested on animals, and then they give it to humans to see what it does, and then if it hurts the humans, they say, well, humans are different than animals, so we really don't know.
Well, let me ask you this. I agree with you about the animals. I agree with the testing, but let me be the devil's advocate for a moment.
Sure.
What would you do to test? How would you test if you didn't use the animal?
That's a very good question. And what you do is, this is why I do what I do, because we realize that most of the diseases are caused by our lifestyle. You don't need to model that in a dog or a monkey or anything else, or a rat, like breast cancer. If you keep on looking for animal models, you're never going to discover that it's the bra. Animals don't wear bras. Humans do. So to test culture-caused diseases, which is the majority of what we're suffering from, you need to test it on people, and most importantly, yourself. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what happens to another group of people. It might not apply to you. You need to know if it helps you or not. And if it's no risk and no cost, it's very easy to do, which is why no one is promoting it but us, because we're a nonprofit. I work with a nonprofit, the Good Shepherd Foundation, that underwrites the Institute for the Study of Culturogenic Disease, which is what I operate my medical anthropology out of. So we just believe that these are human problems.
It is a human problem. We're going to come back and take some phone calls with you, Sydney, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ah, yes, rolling into the first day of summer. Here we go again. This year is halfway through, my friends. We'll be back in a moment. Sydney Ross-Singer and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Sydney, before we take some calls, what about this self-study? What can people do? Where can they go for help?
I think the best place to go is to our killerculture.com website, and that's sort of a portal to a lot of information and to the Self-Study Center, which gives you specific self-studies to try. But killerculture.com is a good place to start.
And give us some tips on what they will find there.
Oh, we have all these articles that we've written that describe what I've been talking about, plus more. It also will give you a bio about myself, what we do here at our institute, And a newsletter. We have Sick Times, which we're starting. It's brand new, and it's a free newsletter that'll go into the newest ideas and research and what you can do for people to try.
Okay. To the phones we go. Jacksonville, Florida, east of the Rockies. It's Dottie's turn. Good morning, Dottie. Go ahead.
Good morning, George, and good morning, Sydney.
Good morning, Dottie.
I had a question about elevating the pillow or the head on the bed. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, what could I use as a home reference to know what a 15 or 20 degree angle, like maybe an upright soda can? And then, Sydney, I wanted to know if you had found any correlation between tinnitus and elevating the head. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good day.
Okay, Dottie.
Well, thank you for that question. Yes, tinnitus, ringing in the ears could definitely be caused by this. Also, whether you're a side sleeper, when you're sleeping on your side, all the weight of your body is resting on the bottom side of your body that's on the bed. So if you, let's say you sleep on your right side, then your right ear will be compressed and your right eye will get more pressure. And people who have uneven sight in their eyes and uneven hearing will find that the one that's worse is on the downside when they sleep, because some people are predominant right side or left side sleepers. So that could definitely cause ringing in your ears. And to elevate your bed, just if you put like a 6-inch elevation, like you said, a soda can standing up, that's about the right elevation at the head of the bed. If you put blocks underneath your bed frame, then just try maybe 4 to 6 inch elevation on that side. It just creates a slight incline plane. And then you could use your regular pillow and then try to stay on your back. But, you have to experiment with it and see what feels comfortable for you. It's one of those very personal things, but that's what I suggest you try.
How do you feel generally, Sydney? Pretty good?
Yes.
Since you've adapted to this lifestyle?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's incredible. I don't know, how do you describe how I feel younger than my years. I breathe healthy air. I drink rainwater. I eat homegrown wild foods, a lot of them, and everything I have, we have goats with milk. I mean, yes, I feel very healthy. I feel very blessed to be able to do this. And I feel it's important to share with people how they can do this. You could do this anywhere on the mainland, too. I mean, there are a lot of places away from the bustle, and you have to get into nature and just feel the healing. It's like nature therapy. And, so I think anybody could feel better just getting out of the rat race for a while and letting your body be natural as much as possible. But, go ahead.
Well, let's go to our first-time caller, Jim, in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is the most interesting show tonight.
Sure,
I had a question about inversion tables. I use it to relieve like lower back pain, and mm-hmm. also was wondering about natural birth control.
Well, what about natural birth control?
Well, women taking the pills, is that good or bad? I'm not sure.
Well, if a woman, that's not natural birth control. I mean, if a woman's taking pills,
they're pills.
It's a pill. I mean, by natural birth control, sometimes there's like timing of when to have sex, when you know you're fertile or infertile and so forth. That's what I think of with natural birth control.
Abstinence is natural.
That's true. and what was the first question you were asking? I'm sorry. There were two of them.
Table, where you connect.
An inversion table. Yeah, I think, sometimes you need more pressure in your head and sometimes less. When you stand up all day, your ankles get swollen because gravity does pull the fluid down and your head gets light, and you sometimes can get a low pressure headache where if you lie down, you feel better. If you ever lie down and feel better from a headache, it's usually because it was a low pressure headache, in which case you may be dehydrated and you might want to consider getting your fluid level up a little bit. But that's from low pressure, and from standing all day, that's what happens. I mean, the fluid just literally drains with gravity. So at those times, lying down and inversion may help for a little while. But, you can kill somebody if their heads are down and gravity just keeps it pooling in the head. Holding somebody upside down can kill them. So I wouldn't do it for an excessive period of time, maybe a couple of minutes. And I mean, even a headstand in yoga, that's supposed to be good for you. It's a nice, good brain flush. But on the other hand, it really, really pumps the pressure in your head and your eyes and your ears. Your whole head gets extremely pressurized. I used to do headstands myself, and I feel like not doing those things have helped me. But I also know that my wife has lower brain pressure than I have. I'm like a little higher pressure than she is. So she sometimes needs to sleep a little lower than I do on the bed. I use two pillows with our normal incline, and she just uses one pillow. So head pressure is a very personal thing. It may change from day to day. It changes with hydration. You got to learn to be just sensitive to how you feel. And that should be your guide. Your body really has, it's like a meter right there, and it tells you, gee, this feels terrible, or that feels better. And that's what pain is for. And that's why you shouldn't use pain relievers excessively, because that shuts off like the fire alarm when your house is on fire. The pain is a feedback mechanism. And not that it's good to be in pain. And if you're in chronic, protracted pain, that could be very bad for you. But just everyday comforts and discomforts and pain is something that's a guide that we have to learn to listen to.
Why do people get migraines, Sydney?
Well, I think they do. And it's been shown to be protective, by the way. People who get migraines are protected by their migraines. What it is when you're down all night and your brain is getting pressurized and it's low in oxygen and low in sugar, the only way it's going to get, I mean, the cells are pressurized. They're sitting in fluid. They're stagnant. It's like brain edema. You have a lot of fluid in the brain. And this is known, by the way, and the pressure in the brain, these are known to occur. But in science, medicine doesn't tell you what's causing it. They just know that we get brain pressure problems with certain diseases. I'm seeing it associated with sleep position. And then the only way to get, the reason you get the migraine is because to get this stagnant fluid out of your brain, the only way to do that is to pump in fresh stuff. So your arteries open in your neck and your brain pressure increases as the fluid is like forced through the flush. It's a brain flush. And after that pain and so forth, it goes through your brain has been like, it has been rejuvenated in its fluid a little bit. So it's a defense mechanism. People who don't have that actually have more brain problems. So migraines are a defense mechanism. And when you raise your bed, people stop needing that defense mechanism. Their brains weren't having the problem of stagnation. And they also experienced it with their sinuses being clearer and their heads being clearer, and they actually slept less. It's like we're just cutting off our brains while we're sleeping to the point where they're getting toxic. And in fact, the end disease, I believe, I haven't proven this yet, but I believe the end disease of this is Alzheimer's, because if you look at the brain of an Alzheimer's patient, the ventricles in the brain, which are these cavities that the cerebral spinal fluid circulates in, those ventricles are expanded, like you pumped extra fluid in and it compresses the brain against the skull as these cavities in it, the ventricles, are expanded. So you look at an Alzheimer's person, they'll have these big ventricles and they'll have lesions all around throughout this, which is what would happen. Dead tissue, if you're pressing on it all the time, tissue is going to start dying. So after years and years, decades of sleeping flat and your head being, you know, congested like this, you can get a disease like Alzheimer's. You can get Alzheimer's, I believe, because of that. It's the end disease of that kind of a process.
Interesting.
There's
okay.
A lot of other diseases that are associated with head pressure, too, by the way.
Yeah.
And even obesity is associated with head pressure, because obese people can't breathe as well. The pressure of their weight on their abdomen actually resists the blood flow down from the heart, and it shifts it up to the head instead. So some severely obese people actually get glaucoma or increased eye pressure because of their obesity and this fluid shift. So losing weight, in that case, would help brain pressure go down. But the other side of it is, if you have high brain pressure, the parts of your brain associated with satiety, which is you're being satisfied after a meal, that part of the brain is known to get congested and excess pressure. And they don't know why, and I think, again, it's sleep position. But that could then make it so you'd want to eat more. You're not satisfied. So changing the way you sleep may actually also change your appetite. and make you less hungry. You'll be satisfied more. Because as soon as your brain is getting too much pressure, there's all sorts of things your brain does for you. I mean, there's hormones it secretes. Your brain is the central nervous system in charge of the way your body operates, and a lot of organs are modulated through the brain. And if you congest the brain by having too much pressure in it and it's deoxygenated fluid and not enough sugar, the brain really needs sugar, then your brain's going to malfunction, and something in your body will malfunction. That might not seem connected, but it's all connected. It's one big body. And that's why sleep position is such a revolutionary thing. And it's sleep medicine doesn't really consider this, but they should. Again, it's something you could test for yourself and see how you feel after it. But people remark all the time that they feel like their lives change within a day or two of elevating their beds. It's that fast.
Okay, let's go to Sandy, Yuma, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Sandy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Sydney, could you explain GMOs? And also, I'd like to know what you feel about AMD.
About which?
AMD, age-related macular degeneration.
Well, okay. Let me talk about GMOs first. I'm not sure I know I have a lot to say about a specific disease of the macular degeneration, although that would also be affected by eye pressure. And I would definitely suggest head elevation for that. But in terms of genetic, this is something I'm glad you raised, because, George, I promised that I wanted to talk about another cause of diabetes and obesity, which is genetically modified organisms that make human insulin. Now, this is something people don't realize, but, you know, years ago when people had diabetes, they took pork insulin, pig insulin. And that created some problems for people with allergies and so forth, because we're humans and we have different insulin. That's so right. There would be a little bit of a reaction. So they have now human insulin that they give diabetics. But that is made genetically by taking the human gene that makes insulin and inserting it into two organisms that different companies do this. One is to insert it in E. coli, which are very common bacteria in our intestine. The other is to insert it into baker's yeast. Now, why do they use these two? They have very simple genomes, and they've been mapped out for years, and they know how to manipulate these genomes. They're very simple, worked-out genomes. So baker's yeast and E. coli are used to they take these human genes, insert it into these organisms. So when these organisms grow in a vat with medium, they start synthesizing insulin. Then you basically... You remove these bacteria or the yeast, and you extract the insulin, and now you have human insulin, and that's what people are taking. Well, the problem is the organisms that they used are ubiquitous. I mean, baker's yeast and E. coli are everywhere. It's in our food, the baker's yeast. I mean, this is what we braise bread with and beer and everything. So it's really stupid, in my opinion, that they use these organisms to be the source of genetically modified human insulin, growth hormone. They do this way. They do several very active biomolecules this way. And unfortunately, these organisms have gotten out of the lab. This has been admitted by the companies doing this. Novo Nordisk is the one that does the human insulin in baker's yeast. I believe Eli Lilly does the E. coli one. And what they did was they've accidentally released live organisms that make human insulin it went down the drain, and it was into the environment. They admit this in their environmental reports. Now, live yeast that make insulin, if this got into our intestines, I mean, this is a food product. If it gets into our body, it could produce and live inside, and we have all sorts of organisms living inside our gut. If it gets established there, it can produce insulin in our bodies. Now, we would absorb that and get what's called hyperinsulinemia. It's as if you were taking pills of insulin if you were able to absorb it that way. So we're absorbing the insulin, and that will suppress your own insulin production, making you insulin dependent, and insulin causes the cells to swell, and people with hyperinsulinemia are known to get obese and diabetes. So I was very concerned that the accidental releases that have happened over several years of these live GMO organisms that produce human enzymes and hormones are being accidentally released into the environment and affecting us. If it gets in our bodies, I predict there's going to be a future of metabolic diseases that doctors are going to be stumped on. They won't know why you're deranged in your metabolism.
And right. They'll have no idea what's going on.
It's in your gut. And it could be that as you eat one thing, it makes stimulates the yeast. Let's say you have big sugary thing and your yeast love it. So suddenly they make more insulin. So you go into it's going to just mess your metabolism. And they won't even think that this is what's going on. But obviously, this to me is just a matter of time. It has already been released. You're not going to find them telling people that this is the case because they're going to freak people out and there's going to be lawsuits. So everyone's going to want to, ignore this. But I think it's a real problem. This is Pandora's box. GMOs are one thing when you eat corn or whatever GMO. I think that's a risky behavior. Anyway, it has to be tested more, and there's science that shows that it causes health problems. So I personally avoid GMOs in my food if I can, and I wish there was more labeling of them.
What do you think about fluoride in water, Sydney?
Well, fluoride in water. I think fluoride is supposed to be good for your teeth. I know, and I'm mixed on that. I don't like drinking. I don't like anybody telling me what to take into my body, so I don't believe in these big public health measures where everybody has to do something because that takes away choice. And I think taking fluoride in excessively by drinking might not be good for you, and it could just very well be that occasional fluoride treatments or, you brush with fluoride, and then you're going to drink it too. It doesn't have to be black and white, all or nothing, but I think we tend to think that way, all or nothing. So I drink rainwater, but, it doesn't have any fluoride in it. But I can't say that my son didn't have some cavities.
Right.
So,
I don't recommend fluoride in the drinking water. I wish they'd take it out.
Yeah, I think it's probably bad. It's not a natural thing to be drinking, and it is a rat poison, and I'm sure it causes all sorts of problems. But, these things get entrenched. What about mercury amalgams?
Oh, same thing. I took all my mercury fillings out. Sydney, stay with us. We're going to hit the top of the hour. We're going to come back with a final hour of phone calls with you right here. So those of you on hold, just hang where you are so you don't lose your place in line. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.